The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Tom Sisti. Tom is Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel at SAP. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to our conversation today, and I, as always, they're always interesting. And Tom, you know, and you focus a lot on acquisition policy and all kinds of issues and things going on this summer or even this year in that area. It's been a very busy summer. So let's dive right into it. We're going to do a little potpourri for this show, and I guess the first one that everybody's talking about out there is the transactional data reporting rule that GSA issued earlier this summer, and sort of the reaction to it, some of the ongoing sort of issues, and your observations about it. And maybe you can take a step back and sort of explain to folks who may not be familiar with it what it is.
I feel like I should be asking you that question since you're the one who sent 65 questions into GSA. But
I don't know what it is. No, I'm just kidding.
Transactional data rule calls on vendors and GWACs and schedules to report 12 categories of information on the transactions that take place under their contract vehicles. That's essentially it. Yeah. GSA is implementing that rule in a series of pilots that are beginning, I guess, this month.
Yes.
Give or take a couple of weeks. And I think that the concern has been expressed on multiple occasions over the past couple of years that the rule is problematic because it seeks a lot of data. There's not an understanding of what's going to happen with that data, how it's going to be used, how the release of that data will be managed in the context of the Freedom of Information Act requirement. And then, you know, some fundamentals about that data. You know, these are pilot programs. How are you measuring these programs for success? Are you going to have metrics identified? Do those metrics identify direct and indirect costs, platform establishment, which is called for? Do they measure the cost of time? Do they monetize that cost so that there's an understanding of the administrative burden on both the government side and the vendor side so that you have a good idea of whether you have a success or not under this program? I don't think it's enough to say, okay, at the end of the day, we had price X, and now we have something less than price X, so we have a win. It's to determine whether you have a win, you have to look at all of the variables that are involved in the transaction and then assess it.
Right. Well, that's a great point. You know, one of the things I'm going to get to, I mean, we can't take all, there's a lot of questions there that that a lot of people are wrestling with. You know, to be fair to GSA, just for a second on it, is that GSA did eliminate the commercial sales practices format and the PRC. If you accept, the requirement to report your transactional data, they did. But still, I think even then they really didn't, because you know the way they're going to negotiate contracts now, right? Is you will submit your proposed price, and there's going to have to be evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, GSA can still ask for additional information under the Part 15 of the FAR, and that's what GSA points to. And in all likelihood, as many observers have said, especially a lot of the subject matter experts in this area who support contract, whether law firms or whatever, is that ultimately contracting officers are going to still ask for CSP, because that's what they know.
I guess the question, what if you get an audit?
That's
a good
question.
If there's an Inspector General audit, what happens to – and – they're looking for that data. Is there an understanding across the agency that data won't be available? And then what happens after the pilot? Does the data have to be produced retroactively? I mean, these sound like nitpicky type questions, but they're significant.
Right. They're really operational, as as our mutual friend Bill Gormley would say. They're right down in the engine room. Like, we could get strategic and go back up, but for right now, that those engine room questions really drive business decisions for companies about how they're going to participate in the federal market. What is their financial cost? What is their financial risk of reporting of the information in that system? And companies right now, they're going through that process of trying to decide, trading off, do I keep what I currently have? Do I go to transactional data reporting? It might be good for some companies. It may not be good for some companies. And they're all out there struggling with that. And I think, that's one of the reasons why the Coalition submitted those questions. Those are questions we got from our members. And I was even surprised at the number of questions and the level of detail back down in that engine room that folks are concerned about, because it does go to, making business decisions about investments.
Well, it reminds me of that dialogue that took place at the Coalition's conference, where there was debate over whether or not the information would be available. And somebody stood up and said, "We know this information is available. It's extant in the ERP systems of the companies." And I think that was the wrong conversation. Of course, can people pull this information? Sure, they can. We can do anything. We're Americans. We can do anything, right? But the question is, does it make sense, and at what cost?
Right.
Generally, will it take to pull this information? I don't think there's ever been a debate about that. What do you have to do to your financial systems, for instance? Do you have to go into the CFO organization now and change things to participate in this marketplace?
Yeah, and one of the, I don't know if anybody has really sort of sat down and thought about it, and I don't mean just GSA, I mean just everybody, that this is a fundamentally new dynamic. This approach, and it is for companies who do a lot of business under the schedules, it is going to be essentially a daily part of their operation. Because I mean, you're getting orders, there's tens of thousands of orders that go through the schedules every day, literally. These companies are going to have to be reporting that and addressing that day after day after day, managing that volume of information that then is going to be provided to the government.
I think the key word there is approach, because the government should always have been doing horizontal pricing. I mean, they were supposed to be doing market analysis, back from the FASA and Klinger-Cohen days. Bless you. Yeah. But the question then is...
I didn't get to the cough button in time.
The question is, how is it being implemented? It's the method that we're talking about here. I don't think the industry would argue that the government should have the best data it should.
Absolutely.
To assess the transaction it's undertaking. No one's, that's not the argument. It's how you do it.
Right. Yeah. It's one of those things that it's with all the uncertainty around it. I think GSA is working on its messaging and providing information to the contractors, but I think there's a curve there that they're—I hate to say—it's somewhat behind, and as evidenced by my view was overwhelmed by the number of questions we got from companies that we ultimately submitted to GSA.
Well, the other thing is there's some language there that appears to indicate that GSA is going to be distributing some information to some vendors. Well, what does that mean? First of all, should the government be in a business development support role for other vendors? That's a threshold question. But if you go back into the history of acquisition reform, and I'm like talking to the middle of the last century.
You're an old guy, I know.
Thank you, Roger. Yeah. And you look at all these old panels, some of the consistent themes that came out of them, one of them was, I don't want to lose my data. I don't go into the government marketplace because I fear that my proprietary data is going to be lost or released or put at risk. So here we are in a new century, and that question's coming up again. What happens to my data once it enters the government space? Is the government going to utilize it in a way that, you know, affects my competitive standing?
Not just in the federal market, but in the entire market, in the commercial market, everywhere, theoretically.
Yes.
Right. So, and that is a big deal. And I think one of the things that, you know, there's such a focus on it. We need to give folks information so they out there so they can make decisions about whether they want to participate in the federal market. Well, the flip side of that is people are going to make decisions not to participate in the federal market because my information, yes. there's a significant risk that some of my proprietary commercially sensitive information is somehow going to get released.
Especially when you're talking about information technology, which is, at its core is intellectual property.
Right. Well, one of the good thing about in that area is that in what we've sort of been alluding to is GSA's announcement that they have a website or whatever where some of this information about transactional data is going to be housed and available to the public. They have asked for comments on what should be protected and not protected. I think that's they have. Those comments are due on August 29th.
I think the baseline is what is protected under FOIA. Freedom Information
right.
Act,
well,
right?
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, too, is the question will be that that's not going to substitute for FOIA, you know, reverse FOIA process or anything like that, just doing this.
Well, remember.
You know what? I'm sorry, Tom. We do have to take a break. We can pick up back on that proprietary information, talk about commercial item contracting and more when we come back. My guest today is Tom Siste. He's a Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel at SAP. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Siste. Tom is Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel at SAP. And Tom, the first segment, which went very, very fast, we talked entirely about transactional data reporting. And I know I cut you off a little bit on your FOIA / discussion. Did you have anything else you wanted to add there?
That you and I in our past lives have done these cases, and you know that there's generally a process where if my data is in with the government, somebody files a FOIA request, there's a period of time during which the government sends out notice to me. I have a chance to send in proprietary markings, redacted versions.
With justification.
With justification, exactly. Yeah. And the government holds on and doesn't release until we work that out. If the government disagrees with me, then I have the right to file a reverse FOIA case and seek to protect that information. Yeah. Well, what's going to happen to that regulatory regime in this new process? Are they going to cut the days short? Are we now in an environment where you mark everything,
right?
So that you can then assert your reverse FOIA because you just need to do it up front and protect yourself.
Right. Well, I think that I know folks are out there, in the bar, advising folks that companies that they should consider marking all the stuff they submit as proprietary to at least have that initial check on the government's potential release or not release, so that at least the government has to go through the appropriate process, right? Another interesting area change this summer that just came out was the proposed GSA rule with regard to commercial supplier agreements. I know it's one of the ones that issue that's near and dear to your heart, especially commercial item contracting and current trends in that area. So I wanted to just throw it out there and get some of your impressions on what's going on.
Well, I think the government has a legitimate concern that it not accept terms and conditions that are inconsistent with federal laws and procurement law, things they can't do. I think this is one of those situations where industry substantively doesn't disagree with the government. I think it's a matter of approach. You'll recall that the government enumerated those categories of information that required specific terms and conditions, and then
right. Well, let's go back to the commercial supplier agreement. Right. Are essentially software license terms or other terms of purchase that are normally used in commercial that could be commercial transactions that contractor could submit for potential acceptance by the government under a commercial item acquisition, right? And so here we're talking about some of the key terms that of those licenses that are typically out there that the government may or may not be able to accept for us, like, for example, choice of law, where a commercial license might say New York State. You know, the federal government says it's federal law, right?
Now, one could argue that that case law handled that already. But you know, belt and suspenders, you want to fix it, that's fine.
Yep.
I think the problem arose when the government took the addendum items in agreements and moved them in the order of precedence for contract interpretation to from where they were to right above the signature page.
Right.
That's not commercial. And I think this is it's a cause for concern because it seems to be a pattern that's evolving where, notwithstanding the fact that we have law that says that the government should leverage commercial terms and conditions to the maximum extent practicable, it is not leveraging those terms and conditions. It's not engaging in those practices. And we've seen some case law on this. You know this, the CGI case, the Verizon case, is it Red River over at GAO? So. I mean, where the government is being called out for this. And it seems like we as an industry are moving towards a situation where if we really have problems with something, we have to litigate this. I'm not sure that's a good place to be for a system that needs to be agile, that needs to engage in very, very fast acquisitions, especially in the technology space where you have such a rapid evolution of technology.
Right. Well, you know, and with the CSA, it's just the far-reaching impact of the commercial supply agreement proposed rule. You know, when you think about it, the definition of commercial supplier agreement is very expansive. It's not just software license. It's any terms of purchase, description of purchase. There's all kinds of language in there. So it's expansive. So I view it as, including anything commercial term that you might attach to your contract is part of the addenda, and it includes the addenda. So so that you start there. So it's all these things. And then basically by changing the order of precedence, you know, all federal clauses, all federal terms control if there's any kind of conflict. And you combine those two things and you've basically, you know, eviscerated commercial item contracting. Wow. I know, like, I mean, I'm just thinking it out. I haven't actually expressed it that way before. I don't think that directly, but it's really formulaically, that's what this does. And that's, I mean, at a time when people are talking about, you know, let's get, you know, agile, let's get innovative companies, all this, even, you know, I would say even let the traditional federal, you know, contractors be more agile, then that's about reducing regulation, not over-regulating. I mean, it's quite remarkable, a sea change in just that little change of order precedence and what it means both from a legal perspective, procurement policy perspective, and then just a perspective about the government's openness to commercial solutions.
Also, there's an operational issue, I think, with respect to incorporating contract terms and conditions, right?
Oh, that's right. There is an issue there that with regard to the rule, it essentially says that you can incorporate by reference so long as you submit complete copies of the terms as part of the offer.
Right. That's like saying I want a dog that's a cat. You know,
right.
I mean, I don't understand why you would incorporate by reference and then take all the clauses you're incorporating by reference and produce them on paper and submit them. The whole point of incorporating by reference is that we have a common understanding of where terms and conditions are, and we're going to use that understanding to govern the contract.
Yeah, it's a whole new paperwork burden. That's in addition to the transactional data reporting burden.
Right, and there's an OIRA issue as
right,
well.
Right. So big picture, just taking the strategic view, just big picture, what it sort of means for the procurement system as a whole. Do you have any thoughts there?
I think we've always, if we go back a few years in our histories,
it's many years.
That's right. That's with Fred Flintstone.
Right.
There's always been a... this kind of push and pull between government and industry, where if industry perceives something as erroneous or otherwise burdensome, that they say, you know, you're going to really affect participation in this marketplace. And government correctly turns around and says, yeah, but you guys still bid. You know, so I don't know that the world is the same. I think you have a much more diverse set of players in the marketplace. They have a more diverse set of markets and submarkets outside of the government. The revenue streams of government are not necessarily dominant in their business models. And it would not be surprising to me if eventually, with these significant upfront burdens or existing burdens for companies, to see players start reconsidering their participation in the market.
Right. Yeah, that's not where we want to go, obviously.
No.
We want to...
No, especially a time where at the same time we have provisions in statute that are trying to encourage so-called innovative firms or non-traditional firms to enter the government space, those firms that aren't performing CAS-compliant contracts, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Tom, we're already up on the next break. My guest today is Tom Sisti. He's Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel at SAP. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about looking at, inventory contracts, business planning a little bit, contract duplication perhaps, or saturation, what's going on out there, and, what tools are in the government's toolbox to address it. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Sisti. Tom is a Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel at SAP. And we're doing an acquisition potpourri today. It's the sort of the dog days of summer. We're in August, and it's been hot out there, Tom. It's been real hot.
Africa hot.
Yeah, very hot. So, hey, this segment, let's talk a little bit about just management. You worked on the Hill in oversight, in the House side and Senate side. Excuse me. I'm sorry. You correct me. I mean, I'm like I said, I am getting old and I forget these things. You lose track of what happened. At least that's what I'm told. And so one of the areas that's always interesting to talk about, and I think it's great. It's on the table, and there's been a lot of focus on it by the current administration, and that's duplication. And in the context of contract duplication, what's unnecessary contract duplication, what's appropriate, how does the government manage that? Do you have thoughts in that area?
Well,
of course you do, because otherwise we wouldn't be doing the show. I know that.
I think you point to the key phrase, unnecessary or inappropriate duplication. I think to just have as a goal eliminating duplication may not be wise, because there are instances where you do have contract duplication because of program mission. The intel community might do the same thing as a non-intel agency. That doesn't mean they should both be on the same contract, because reducing duplication is the ultimate goal. It should be reducing inappropriate duplication. And you see it in FITARA. You see it in a number of bills being considered now. Move IT Act has that language in there. I mean, so chasing duplication mm-hmm. is not necessarily the best goal you could have.
It's not the end goal.
Right.
That's right. It's like it's strategic. It's like what's the right balance? What's the right mix of contracts?
Exactly.
There are too many. I think there's been a consensus on that. And to the administration's credit, they're focusing on that. But then they get to the question, what's the right mix and what's the appropriate number? And how do you determine this is a new phraseology is out there all the time. We hear right from the government, best in class.
Yeah. What are the criteria for best in class?
Right. And who's going to be picking
it? And who picks it? And is it outside of a contracting process? You're talking about people who are performing subject to terms and conditions set forth in the requirements. So if they've performed subject to those terms and conditions, what is the overlay that makes them best in class or not best in class?
Right. And that's, I think that's the $250 billion question or something like that, right? That's
right.
What's really to try to figure that out. Is quite a challenge. Well, and I know this is an area you're big on. It's that there are lots of tools some tools in the government's toolbox in terms of managing the quote inventory or portfolio of contracts, especially in the IT area. Want to talk a little bit?
Well,
people don't focus on those a lot. I think everybody's focusing right now on this business case analysis that OMB's put in place for big GWACs or IDIQ contracts. But there have been before, and that's, how effective that has or hasn't been, I don't think we even know yet. The jury's still out, but been a process in place, right?
This goes to the issue of duplication that you started with. First and foremost, and I think the statutes call for it, the government should have an inventory of what it owns. I mean, you can't manage if you don't know what you're managing. So it's fair for them to do that. This whole duplication issue, though, has raised a question. There are structures in place to manage duplication. If we have contracts that are inappropriately duplicative, then the question is, how did they get through the Exhibit 300 and the Exhibit 53 process? That's the tool through which they're supposed to be managed, especially in a post-Clinger Cohen Act environment.
But yeah, those are
capital investment planning
and where the agencies are supposed to let OMB know what they're going to buy, what their plans are for IT investments and that sort of thing. And
so, I mean, it's well and good to think about different ways to bring contracts together and things like that. But at the outset, there's a process in place that's supposed to be followed to weed these things out, to assess them not only from a sort of static capability and feasibility standpoint, but from an overarching standpoint as well.
Right. And then GSA plays a role in there. I mean, you have in the IT world, you got GSA and Alliant 2 and those contracts, mm-hmm. and NASA SOUP and NIH's contract family are supposed to be like leveraging and trying and giving folks opportunities to, rather than creating their own, utilize those, right? That's mm-hmm. part of the problem. So that in mind, there's, and again, I don't want to keep harping on a theme, but we're old guys and we've seen like centralization, decentralization. I know you're shaking your head, and I think, what's your observation about the debate about the management structure, centralization versus decentralization?
Yeah, I just think that's a tremendous oversimplification of the situation. It's centralization or decentralization. Those are means to an end. The end driver should be mission and mission fulfillment. So it's this idea that we're going to achieve something through centralization that we can't achieve now. I don't know, because I don't know what the mission is. Am I identifying communities of interest, if you will, where we can sort of aggregate and leverage the buying power of the government? Or am I just saying we're going to overlay a system that requires this kind of centralization? Yeah, I think we have to remember there's this notion of subsidiarity, that you want to have action. You want to have management discretion delegated down to the level that's closest to the point of action, because that's where the requirements are best understood.
Absolutely. And it seems to me, and it's a great observation, that it's not a simple, black-white decentralization versus centralization type discussion or even set of concepts. I mean, it seems to me it's much more nuanced, much more balanced, and it's much more complicated in an entity as large as our government, with all the various missions, missions within missions, departments within agencies, and I mean, just it goes on and on.
Well, we have a history where we had this kind of centralization, and the changes that were implemented were not in response to the notion of centralization. They were focused on bringing discretion to the people who were accountable, who had budget authority, who were closest to the mission that had to be implemented.
Right. And on that note, Tom, we're already up on our next break. Wow. We got one more break to go. One more segment to go, excuse me. And in that segment, I think we'll talk a little bit about, get some of your thoughts on the keys to successful procurements. We can talk a little bit about, I know we want to touch on, which this is potpourri, Tom. We want to talk a little bit about LPTA, where we are on that. That still draws a lot of attention from folks. I get questions about it all the time. maybe touch on category management. We'll see how much time we have. My guest today is Tom Sisti. Tom is Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel at SAP. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Sisti. Tom is a Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel at SAP. And Tom, you know, one of the things this segment, we talk about continue our potpourri discussion, various topics. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you and get your thoughts on are, you know, what's the key or keys to a successful outcome in a procurement? What fundamentally, it's not just, and I'm not talking about just, you know, you got an award. Wow, I can, you know, walk away and, you know, that's the sexy part. You know, it's the overall. You know, has a contract furthered an agency mission? You know, met an agency requirement? You know, supported, you know, our government?
Well, I think, you know, as we discussed in the last segment, that you want to have identified accountability closest to the point of transaction, closest to the budget determinations. But I think that you also want to have stakeholder involvement. It's just almost an axiom at this point. One of the fundamental problems with government procurement is requirements definition. You saw it when you sat on the SARA panel. If you don't have your requirements defined, I don't care what you're implementing, it's going to be a problem.
Right.
And so really nailing down requirements definition requires not only the individuals with the expertise to do that, but it requires stakeholder involvement. It requires participation by the people who are going to have to live with the system. And that's not just in writing down those requirements.
You mean the program people, right?
Right, exactly.
People, okay.
It's an iterative process. It's one that requires constant feedback. It requires, and this is even before award, it's where are we in structuring this acquisition, and should we be structuring as one big massive buy, or should we, on very complex acquisitions especially, be breaking these buys into smaller
modules,
exactly, yeah. So that you can identify whether they meet the needs or are deviating in the context of implementation. When you've made an award and you have a team there, I think it goes back to the GTO 21 study, the commission, which said that all stakeholders, including subcontractors, should be engaged in the process so that everyone has a common understanding of what it is the government is trying to achieve in the performance of an acquisition.
Right, so everybody's like, I guess, rowing or pulling the oar in the same direction, right?
Right.
Right, unified. And, to follow that up, just it seems to me that the great activity, and I, you know, just, and maybe it's because I deal with a lot of process, but it seems like there's been a great deal of emphasis about process over the last, decade or so. Going back to the 90s, there was an effort to reduce the amount of process so you could focus on the requirements. Is that your sense as well? Or?
Yeah, we seem to be process intense at this moment. That could be a problem, because I think when your mission is subordinated to the process is supposed to fulfill the mission.
Mm-hmm.
If the mission is subordinated to the process, then the process becomes the mission.
Right. And speaking of processes or management, and we probably should have talked about this in the last segment, but I'm bringing it back around. You know, when we talked about centralization versus decentralization as sort of a management approach, you know, the other, you know, the catchwords of the day these days right now are category management. And what does that mean? And more to the point, is it, where do you think it's going? What is the goal here?
Well, I think category management almost strikes me as trying to buy as one, mm-hmm. okay, as the administration would say, but it's identifying clusters of goods and attempting to buy as much as you can together. But it goes back to this issue of the driver. Is the driver the mission or just the process of buying together? I'm not sure what you're going to get out of this. It's a management tool. So I've been concerned when I see it pop up sometimes as a suggestion for legislation, because I just think back 100 years, if we put time motion studies in statute, would we have to amend a statute to change our management approach? I mean, so it's one of those things. You have the flexibility in the system to do what you want. You don't need it in statute. But again, it goes back to making rational decisions around, I was saying before, communities of interest, but common missions,
right,
where you can align these things.
Yeah, I think the problem about statute is that by passing a law to enshrine a particular management approach, you know, it draws a conclusion that there's only one effective way to do it for all time. Because as we all know, we always just say it's much easier to change a regulation or a management process than to change a law.
That's right.
Right?
It's interesting because it's almost at a time when we're talking about engaging in agile acquisition and agile development. You're kind of fixing in stone a management approach.
Right. I know potpourri, here we are. I got another issue I wanted to run by you, and I know it's still out there, LPTA. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of noise around that, you know, recent bid protest as well involving that approach. What do you have any thoughts on, you know, where we are as a government on that?
I think you have to draw a distinction between those situations where price is clearly the determining factor and those where price is a dominant factor.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a complex acquisition that has mission imperatives, you know, price may not be as important as certain levels of performance. And again, I'm thinking military applications, things like that. But in situations where you have a fairly good sense of what the technology is that you're buying, that you certainly want to look at the differences between the qualitative differences between systems, but price is dominant, then you're really not talking LPTA anymore. You're talking best value. So, you know, A is more important than B, B is more important than C, and A, B, C is less important than D, and D being price. That's best value, really, in a simple way.
Yeah. And price dominant versus low price technically acceptable, that could mean, you know, that means many, to me, that means sort of many different things. And price dominant is an interesting term that you're using there, because I never heard quite, you know, heard it phrased that way. You know, in the typical acquisition context, is price is more important than, or technical is significantly more important than price.
Yeah, but it's effectively, that's what it is in a best value. If price is more important than the other factors.
Right, then it is, it becomes dominant.
And the other factors have defined percentages. I mean, we've seen this in the M sections.
Well, perhaps that's what we'll see moving forward more in the future, is a higher value placed on price in a best value context. Mm-hmm. Than, I mean, usually, typically, it's always significantly more. I mean, I saw so many technical significantly more important than price. It's
the mission drove that.
Yeah. And also discretion. I mean, mm-hmm. it gives to that point about meeting mission, it gives the evaluators and the social selection authority even greater discretion in terms of the value to a particular technical approach. You know, I mean, that was kind of the whole point of it, I think, a little bit as well. Mm-hmm. So we got about a minute left or so, and it goes fast, Tom. You're looking at me, wow. So I wanted to give you a chance. Tomorrow is the Joseph P. Caggiano Memorial Golf Tournament that the Coalition is hosting. That tournament is honor a Joe, who is a member of our board. And the proceeds from the tournament, the net proceeds, go to the Coalition's fellowship at George Washington University, that the fellowship will support deserving veterans who are either studying at the law school and focusing on government procurement law, or receiving a our veterans receiving a master's at GW in their program that focuses on the procurement system, federal procurement system. I just want to give you a chance to throw your two cents in there.
Well, Joe was a good friend of ours. He left us way too early. I think that this is a great opportunity to honor him and to do something good for the procurement community by sponsoring this chair. You don't have to golf to go out there. I go out there to eat. So
right. Yes, you do. And you do that very well, I might say. Nothing more? Hey, I thought you'd have a...
Truth is truth.
Right. Okay. Well, and on that note, I want to thank my guest, Tom Sisti. He's a senior director and chief legislative counsel at SAP. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.